and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is a phenomenal stand-up comedian, television developer, previous holder of the creative residency at Baby Cow, writer for ITV2's Emily Attack Show and the Now Show on Radio 4, and a noted clowning enthusiast. We recorded the interview at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival way back in August, which, to be honest, feels like a lifetime ago, as the bangs you might be able to hear outside my window reveal that I'm recording this introduction on November the 5th. But back in August, in the height of the Scottish summer, we talked about finances, fighting against being pigeonholed, haunted pubs, and the joy of silly comedy. And, to be honest, a lot of other things as well. So let's not waste more time here and just get straight into it. Please welcome my guest for this week, Mary O'Connell. Mary, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're here at The Fringe with a fantastic work in progress show, There's Something Wrong with Mary.
Yes.
So it's only right we start with, what's wrong with you?
I guess the show is sort of about trying to figure out or explore those areas, because I know that there's like many things wrong with me, but the main thing is I think certain things that I don't think that I should think, and I don't necessarily agree with them, but I can't help thinking them, and I want to interrogate the way my brain works or the way that I've been conditioned by society to think certain things, which are like unwoke and bad. Mm-hmm. But I can't help it but think these things. And so that's sort of like part of the journey of the show. But my main thing right now is like, I guess, being obsessed with money and not feeling like I can have a good time because I'm worried about money, and maybe being like, you can only have a good time when you're like financially secure. Mm-hmm. And any time apart from that, you shouldn't be having fun, which is so stupid.
Finances are a big element of your show.
Yes.
Why? I mean, obviously they are important inherently. Mm-hmm. Why are they so important to you?
I think because for me, financial freedom means freedom. Mm. Like, and I do think that we're not sort of like financially literate as a society. Like, there's so much that we're not taught about. And because I sort of earn money in an unconventional way, I think I just try to think a little bit more innovatively about money. I think, do you know what happened? I did a literature degree, and after that, I just couldn't read fiction. Like, for ages, I just couldn't read fiction.
Sure.
And so I read like the Freakonomics book, and I thought it was so interesting. Because, like, you know, it's like, it's about economics, but it's also about like data and what like research shows us about human behavior. And it's like, well, this is the data, these are the facts of like why this sort of stuff happens. Mm. And I listened to the podcast a little bit, and the podcast, they just sort of like talk about a topic and be like, why do people tip? Can we live in a society? And it's a US thing, so it's sort of like more important for tipping there. Mm-hmm. And they talked about investing and like how, and like, and I realized, I guess everyone's relationship to money is different, because I only got a credit card like last year, but not everyone should get one because it depends on your relationship to money. And I thought that that was interesting, how some people could be like, I have £300 in savings and this is like really good for me. And someone could be like, I have £30,000 in savings and this is really bad for me. Like, it just depends. And I like seeing those little, I think it's like Refinery 29, where they do like, this is what this person earns, this is what's in their savings account, this is how they spend their money. And like just hearing different people and their relationship to money. Because I have an interesting relationship to money where I have some. I have some, not loads and loads, but I think I have like a bit. Mm-hmm. Don't want to lose it. Yeah. Don't want to lose it. And so I'm like, well, you can't go out and have fun and do fun things because then you'll lose money. What did you ask?
I asked what you had for breakfast. why finances are so important to you.
Yes.
So,
you know. Yeah. Because I do equate, and I was talking in the show today about sort of like, basically like, we don't live in like an equal society. Not everyone's on like an equal playing field. Like, you have sort of like white being like a base norm, neutral level. Mm-hmm. And like everyone else. And so for us to have more equality, there needs to be more financial freedom. So, because all I want is for everyone to have the same sort of like, just come into the world a bit more neutrally. Because that it doesn't mean that like being different is bad. It's fine. Like it's completely fine, and that makes things beautiful. But when I don't know your economic background and sort of like race, ethnicity, and religion colors your life so much that it means that you don't, it's not an equal playing field, then money is the thing that can make things more equal. That's how I feel. And so I'm actually a socialist at heart. I don't know. I don't know if that's believable. I don't know if I am.
We'll just start playing Les Mis in the background. Leave the rally. Listeners can't see right now, but she's waving a huge red flag. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great leveler. And it seems to be how the class system is done in America, is it's done on wealth as opposed to landed gentry, or that you are related to someone who signed the Magna Carta.
Yes.
It's about how much money you currently
have. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And generational wealth.
Yeah. And they have a terrible capitalist society, like, because they have more of like a free market type situation there. And I mean, but like, there's this thing, like, we like, you know, we sort of technically live in a welfare state, but it doesn't really feel like that anymore. And it feels like it's becoming less and less equal, and like class disparity and social mobility is becoming harder and harder. And I do feel like what I'm talking about is kind of just like a product of the time.
Yeah.
I also noticed, so I do like, I work in TV. I did like an MA in film studies, and I was sort of working TV development as my day job. And it's quite, I quite like that I have like a whole career outside of comedy, but also it involves comedy. Mm-hmm. And I noticed trends. There's loads and loads of trends within sort of like TV. And you have sort of like, let's say like the slacker culture of like Gen X in the 90s, like Clerks or Clark. I feel like my dad always corrects me and says it's Clerks, but I'm like Clerks, whatever. Kevin Smith.
Sure. One of them's silent anyway.
Yeah, so exactly. And that sort of thing, or like Reality Bites. And then we have the workplace, like the workers' family, like the US office and stuff like that. And it's like, no, like, you know, it can be fun. Like your work family is your family. Mm-hmm. And then we have the sort of like Google and like Silicon Valley and like making being like overworked seem glamorous, and being like a workaholic making that seem cool because there's beanbags in the office. Like that's a trick.
Uh-huh.
That's a trick. You like, they're tricking you into thinking you're not unhappy.
Yeah. Pizza Fridays and food.
Exactly. Like they're giving you beer instead of more money. Yeah. Like, and now we're sort of moving into a place where it's work is, especially because of the pandemic, and like it's really sped up, I think, social phenomena, because people can work from home. People are moving out of cities because they don't need to work in cities necessarily anymore. Sure. And so we have shows like Severance, which, or like stuff like Black Mirror stuff, which shows the workers like this dystopian world. And so I feel like I'm part of that sort of feeling like work and my relationship to work and money is like, this isn't real. This is absurd and it isn't real. And what I want to talk about in the show, which is, I've not quite managed to do it yet, is I love scammers. I love fraud. I love financial crime. I think firstly, it's great.
That's not how you accrued all this money.
It's sort of like, because I feel like scams are having a real moment.
They're having a big moment.
It's nice to get your sort of like true crime fix from like not women being murdered,
like,
because like a lot of the time it's just like, oh, violence against women, that's entertainment. And this is just like, I find it so interesting, like the nature of scammers. And I want to talk about Anna Delvey in the show, because she's my favourite.
I'm sure.
This
is Inventing Anna.
Yes, Inventing Anna. And I listened to the podcast like before there was a show, so I was obsessed with her before everyone else was.
You're the original fan.
Like, yeah. I've been following her on Instagram for a long time. Do you know she's doing NFTs? She's making, like, she's doing doodles and drawings. They're quite good, but she's making them into NFTs, and I want one.
At what point does it become a cult?
I guess... I guess it already is. Because I think what I want to sort of try and talk about in the show is that she is someone who's like not particularly pretty, not particularly charming, but she just conned her way into like high society with like confidence and like just pretending that she was meant to be there. Mm-hmm. And it kind of shows you that it's all fake. Like, it's all fake. The things that we, like, hold dear, like class and wealth and status, it's all fake because she's fake. And she was able to do it. She was going to do it. And I think that that's amazing. And if she'd just said that it was performance art, I don't think she'd go to prison.
No, she'd win an award here.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think it's trying to interrogate, because yeah, I am definitely obsessed with scams, but I want to know why I'm obsessed with scams. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about being a rule breaker that I'm trying to get across in the show, because I talk about people with tattoos, I talk about polyamorous people, and I see, and I'm saying that I sort of like, I have a resentment towards people who are breaking the rules, because I feel like I'm following the rules and all I'm trying to do is be successful by following the rules, like in the best way that I can. And then I see other people like breaking the rules and having a good time. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, who said you could do that?
Yeah.
Who said that was allowed? So yeah, again, what did you ask? I don't...
I can't remember for that one. But going back to the idea of equality and sort of finding the playing field, you have a bit in your stand-up which really stuck out, which was that some advice you got at some point, which is you can only be three things in comedy.
Yeah.
And you, as a brown queer woman,
yeah,
fill up those three straight away, and then there's no room to be anything else.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because I sort of say that, like, white people, particularly white men, are, like, the norm. So... if you're, like, different, I mean, I don't think that it's necessarily the case all the time. It depends. But, like, back in the day when, like, women did stand-up, they'd sort of, like, have to address the fact that they were a woman. Or, like, you know, like, if you're anything different that's, like, than a white man, you have to address it and be like, and this is why I'm here, and explain your identity to the audience. Whereas white men don't have to do that because we're like, this is normal. This is our base level. We know why you're here. And I find that really frustrating because I think it means that there's less time for you to do this more wacky shit, or and people just, they're not as open towards you. Like, they're just not, like, you know, like sometimes doing performing comedy and you're in like a compilation show, you can sense people, like if it's been like male acts and then like you're the first woman on, you can feel the energy in the room change. And so you have to just, like, try harder. You have to be better to be thought of as being just as good. And you have to, like, spend more time winning them over and being like, I'm different, but I'm here. And I don't necessarily want to talk about the reasons that I'm different in that way. It just depends. Like, everyone's got a right to talk about their identity and, like, and do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. But I think what I've always wanted to do is... I don't know, just sort of, like, talk about email and stuff that annoys me. And that can change... but it's just the fact that you have to reduce yourself into these, like, three parts. And I don't really feel like... firstly, that's not all I am. I don't think those are the things that make me interesting. Because I've never really felt... and I was trying to say in the show today, like, I don't feel like me being, like, a mixed-race queer woman was, like, that strange. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it depends on sort of, like, your upbringing, where you're from. Like, because I'm from London, so I'm like, yeah, this is everyone here. Like, I never felt like I was... not normal. And then, I mean, I went to uni in York and then I was like, oh, am I different? I thought that I was like the same as everyone else. And I think, I know it's useful to have differences. It's great to like talk about the stuff that makes you different, but I don't think that it should be how you market yourself to audiences. I don't like pandering to people. And so I've liked, I used to do a bit where I say, my dad's white, you can work out the rest. Like, well, because it's so dismissive. It's so dismissive of, like, my racial heritage. But I thought it was so funny, like, just to be so dismissive of it. Because it's like, whatever. Yeah, I do think within comedy, you're, like, you're supposed to sort of, like, reduce yourself to, like, three things. And a white man would never reduce himself to be like, okay, so I'm a white man. And my, like, and you know, my shoe size is this, like, it would be like, no, my parents are divorced, I'm depressed, and, you know, I went on like a gap year, just, I don't know, something else like
Yeah, I think I know. yeah, and you have an innate love of whimsical comedy, it seems. And some of the bits from your show on Getty Images and Kettle Boiling, which listeners will have to see the show to understand those, but they'll understand it when they see it. But the Getty Images stuff, it's been in my head. It's fantastic. And it is that sort of that whimsical, fun, kind of silly jokes.
Yeah. I really like doing stuff like that. I still don't really have like an end to that Getty Images joke. But I think I do have, I love all types of comedy. Mm-hmm. Like I really enjoy so much comedy. I'm definitely like a student of comedy. Mm-hmm. I guess one of my gripes with the comedy industry is that there aren't many black and brown alternative comedians.
Sure.
Because we don't necessarily know how to operate in those spaces, because alternative comedy is like usually like, because people are expecting stand-up, so you're expecting stand-up and then someone does something that's like so not stand-up. Mm-hmm. And they're like, whoa,
yeah,
I've got to process this. But like, and it's like, okay, white man doing something which is really not stand-up, they're like, okay, I can process it. It's like, okay, it's two steps for me to do. But if you have like a woman or like a brown person doing clowning or whatever, they're like, too much, it's too much, I can't handle it. And so that's something that annoys me. And I was talking about clowning because I did this clowning course, and you do have to be okay with failure in clowning, and you have to feel safe to play, and you have to be able to like find joy on stage. But and my clowning teacher was so like, he was so cool, but he talked about bombing loads. It's like you sort of have to be okay with bombing when you're a clown. And I was like, I have to make money. I can't just go around the circuit being really bad. Yeah. And I get like, you sort of have to like, you know, like be a little bit bad before you can be really, really good. But when you're doing something that's so out there, mm, and you're already presenting something visually that people don't quite understand, or it's like another level to what they can process of a performance. Mm. I think it's really hard to do stuff that's a bit more alternative. And also, like, you know, like, I'm like, I would say I'm like in between mainstream and alternative. I'm not like, anytime I do like an alternative night, I'm always like the most like straight edge kind of person there. Because someone would be like a banana costume or something like that. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that.
I'm just screaming for 45 yeah. minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that it's like, it's a representation thing, it's an audience thing, it's a performer thing that we all just have to progress. Like, I just want to see some black clowns.
Yeah.
I just want to see some black people doing clowning and see how it goes. Because I love clowning so much. I've been banging on so much at the Fringe about how much I love clown. And some people fucking hate clown. Some people hate and they're like, Mary, shut the fuck up, it's so stupid. Like, but I just like the idea of like people having so much fun, mm-hmm, on stage. Because I think I have more fun on stage, or I look like I'm having more fun on stage, because I'm always having fun, but it didn't always used to look like that. Like, mm, I used to be a lot more deadpan and I quite stiff. I mean, I move a little bit on stage now, but not a lot. But a lot of the time, my show, so in 2019, I split an hour with my friend Patrick Healy, who's amazing, he's a great comedian. And we both sort of like, at that time, had the stage presence of like, I could be somewhere else. And our show was called Barely There. it was fun to do. But yeah, that's sort of like, and I can see how my stage presence and persona has changed a bit, because mm-hmm, I'm always fairly high status. But I would say that I'm usually like high status, low energy, but it's changing a little bit now. I'm like, sometimes I'm a bit more high energy in stuff.
To clarify, by high status, what do you mean?
It means that you're sort of like, you're kind of above the audience. Like, some people are like, oh my God, I went on a date and like, it was really bad. Like, just like, and you're sort of like, you're laughing at them. I mean, like, we're all sort of like laughing at it and the material. Mm-hmm. But I think like high status is being like, I could be suicidal and I still think I'm better than you. Like that sort of thing.
Sure.
which I think is funny. And it's a little bit harder to be vulnerable when you're high status on stage, because people are like, what are you doing? Like, yeah, you said that you were high status. How am I supposed to like see you being vulnerable now? But there's ways to do it. It's just a bit more challenging, I think.
And audiences do tend to accept how a performer presents themselves. So
yes,
if they present with the energy of, this is a big deal for you, it's not for me, mm-hmm, they'll go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And vice versa. Likewise, if they're really embarrassed on stage, the audience is embarrassed for them.
Yes. Yeah. So it's like, and it's fun to play around with status, because I think you should always be able to like make fun of yourself. Like, I can still definitely make fun of myself, and I probably do for the most part. But it's like, I know that these things are ridiculous, but I'm still going to do them. It's like, that's the sort of, like, my version of high status.
Yeah. Because you're operating on your own level.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, if you don't get it, that's your problem.
Yeah.
Do you feel clowning helps sort of with that, helps improve that sort of that confidence and sort of persona and presentation?
I think definitely, like, just like physically, being able to like embody a character a little bit more, and being able to not just sort of like have the material, but have like a whole performance. For ages in stand up, I didn't even use my face. I didn't use my face. I didn't express anything on my face because I was like, no.
Oh, I thought you meant you wore a mask. Oh. Like Seer.
Yeah, I just did stand up with my back turned to the audience. And I'm like, these jokes are enough. You don't need to see me. But yeah, no, I just sort of like forgot that you could. I was like, I think my inflection is quite good. I've worked on my inflection and like sort of like, you know, making sure I say something in the funniest way in my voice. Yeah. But I didn't use my face for ages. And then I was like, oh, I can do a facial movement that adds to the joke. And it becomes more of a performance that way, I think. And it just depends on what's right. Like, there are some comedians who, like, probably won't use their face. And it's fine. It's fine. It just, like, you know, it depends on, like, who you are as a performer. And I think, yeah, doing clowning definitely opened up a different way of performing that I probably won't ever pursue, because there's no money in clowning.
Is it not? Is that not how to do the retire early?
Yeah. No. Like, make all that clowning money and then live on an island.
It's why Piero is so sad. Because he didn't have a 401k. Well, you mentioned before about working in television, and you were, I think, until recently, or maybe you still are, Baby Cow creator.
Yes.
Residency.
Yeah.
What is/was that? How did that manifest? What did it consist of?
So it was really cool. It was like, it's basically like a writer's residency that I did for 6 months at Baby Cow, and I now work there on the development team.
Oh, cool.
It wasn't anything I applied for. They just sort of like approached me through my agents, and I was like, oh my God, is this the best opportunity that's ever happened?
Yeah.
And it was part time, technically, but like, I just feel like I can't really do part time.
Is it that you give 100%?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. No, I'm there 5 days a week. Okay. No, it was a part time job, but like a full time salary. And I had to leave my other job, which was like development at another production company. Mm-hmm. And so I got to develop a few things with Baby Cow that are still like in development there. And it was really, really cool. But I found it weird. I found it really difficult at first because we were sort of like working from home a fair bit, and it's like meeting a new team over Zoom just isn't quite the same. Sure. And because I realized that I didn't, and it was suddenly, it was me as a performer, as like a writer performer, having a job with like a steady income where I'm like, no, this doesn't track. This isn't like, this isn't the odd gig or the odd digital thing. This is like, this is my salary for doing what I like to do.
Yeah.
And even like, because I love my other job as well. Like, I love TV is what, like, it's the other thing that I'm super passionate about. But because I was so used to sort of like doing comedy on the side and like sneaking bits in and trying to find the time,
sure,
when it was like, no, this is what you're being paid to do now, I was like, obviously something's wrong. Obviously something's wrong.
Where's the catch?
Like, yeah. And I found it hard to like value my work as a writer performer because I'm like, no, you do the salary job. This is that. And then the writer performer stuff, you sneak it in. You just sneak it in. You do it when you're not supposed to be doing it. And now I'm supposed to be doing it.
Like dessert for a main course.
Yeah. And it was really tricky to place value on it. And it's still kind of tricky now because I work there, and I'm also like, but working on my script is also part of my job still. But these other scripts that we're working with writers, like who are like full-time writers, that must be like more important. Whereas like you have to put value on your own creative work, which I'm still struggling with, because I'm like, but that's the gamble one. You know, the reason I have a whole other job is because I don't want to gamble on just this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting having a job, which is also like a whole career, which is someone else's dream job. Like, my day job is someone else's dream job, and I love it. I do love it, but, like, it's not my dream job. Mm-hmm. But it's still a really, really cool job, and I learn a lot. And I think, and the team is great, and it's interesting to sort of see the industry from inside as well as out.
Totally, and it can only improve writing to some extent because you know what people are looking for.
Yes.
Or at the very least, commissionability.
Yeah. No, definitely. What are the trends? What's going on? BBC wants stuff that's like a bit more broad. There's like four. I went to like a comedy conference in Newcastle in May, which is like a training for Edinburgh because it felt like it was like, oh my God, I'm exhausted. And BBC are looking for like four new things as like, or basically they fully acknowledge that the way that we consume content has changed. The world has changed so much because of the pandemic. And so they're like, iPlayer is king. And so they're not really booking for like time slots as much anymore. It's more about like iPlayer. And I thought it was really interesting that like, because they're like, people rewatch comedies. People return to comedies, but like people watch dramas like once.
Yeah.
And so comedy is about like, it's like the lifespan of a show. And the fact that like, yeah, if it's Christmas, I'm going to watch Vicar of Dibley. Like, obviously.
Sure.
Like, obviously I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was interesting.
What else are they looking for?
What else are they looking for? So, like, stuff that's broad. Mm-hmm. So, like, that could be kind of like communal viewing. So, like, Mrs. Brown's Boys counts in that. Ghosts counts in that. They're looking for, like, workplace sitcoms, I think. Workplace and family sitcoms, because those do really well. Like, Motherland did really, really well. Because they get so many comedy dramas. Like, obviously, like, the whole Fleabag era, like, it's, like, comedy drama. But I think people... there's a trend of like just being a little bit more positive, like a little bit warmer. Yeah. Because like, look at Ted Lasso.
Sure.
Amazing, amazing show. Just like super warm and nice. And I think the other one is like reputational stuff. So that's like, you know, like the best legendary people doing like their thing. So like Inside Number 9, Partridge, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the categories, but that's just the BBC. Like, other channels look for other things.
Sure. I get the feeling that you grew up pretty obsessed with comedy. You took part, I think, even in the Chortle Student Awards in 2015.
I know.
Probably even earlier, I don't know.
How embarrassing. That's on YouTube forever.
We'll drop a link in the bio.
No.
You can all check it out.
Please don't.
Make sure to like and subscribe.
Yeah, I did. So, do you know what? I did like 5 gigs when I was 17 before, like, it was the summer in between like AS and A2 of A level, and you could do this thing called an EPQ or an extended project where the aim was like to write, perform and film your own stand-up routine. Well, that was my aim. So like, you could do it on whatever you wanted, but that was what I wanted to do. And I did those 5 gigs and I was good. I was all right. But I just sort of like saw the kind of life that you would have if you're a comedian. And I thought it was a bit sad. And so I was like, no, I'm like, you know, like, I'm young, I'm sprightly, I don't need to do that. And also I had exams and shit, and like, I was like 17, so. Sure. And then I didn't really do stand-up again. I did it a tiny bit at uni, but not properly, which is my Chortle videos are so bad. And I think I always had like one foot in, one foot out. I never wanted to properly commit to it because I talk about stand-up being like a risk or a gamble in my show. Mm-hmm. And so I only really started gigging regularly in like 2019, maybe like late 2018, but like 2019 was like, no, I'm committing now. I'm committing to it. Mm-hmm. And I had like a fun fringe. I did that. And then 2020 pandemic, sure. Shit.
Okay. So you're relatively new to the scene with gusto.
I think it's like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I've been around for a long time, but not.
Yeah. You've been in the orbit.
Yeah. I've been in the orbit, but I've like maybe did like 3 gigs a year until 2019. Sure. That sort of thing, which doesn't really count.
It counts.
I don't count it because I can't have people thinking that I've been doing comedy for like 7 billion years.
Why can't you have them thinking that?
Well, like, because it's sort of like, you know, the fresher you are, it's more impressive.
I see, sure.
And so it's like, yeah, I've been here for like 6 months.
This is your first time on stage.
This is my first ever gig.
You were looking at the exits. Is this thing on?
I just went into the room and did a show. which I think, do you know what? It's which is probably like my own problem, but like comedy is gotten very ageist, I think, in the last 8 to 10 years. It's super, super ageist, which is so dumb because it's not ballet. Like, you can, like, anyone... Anyone can do it.
Yeah.
But there are certain comedians who are like, are above a certain age and maybe look a certain way, who don't get enough recognition and attention that they deserve because they're super talented. Mm. But comedy is very ageist and it feels like everyone's like looking for like the hot new, like offbeat middle class person. And so it does feel like if you're above a certain age, it's like, are you past it? Which I think is wild. But I'm someone who is like, I'm ageist. Like, I'm so, like, I don't want to be, I don't mean to be, but like, you notice, like, it's like, you can see what's happening. Mm. And you see how people like get treated in the industry. So I'm sort of like lucky enough because I'm like still relatively young. I started comedy quite young and I'm still relatively young. So I'm okay. but yeah,
sure. And it's not the case with acting because you have figures like sort of Al Pacino or Meryl Streep, and no one's going, you're too old to act in the film. And that's when you're potentially playing a real person. You kind of have to look in some you have to look a certain way, otherwise it wouldn't. Daniel Radcliffe playing a 1,000-year-old man would actually, I quite like to see that independent. but with comedy it does seem to be like sort of you're part of the old guard, let's move on to you, as you mentioned before, you've got an MA in film studies.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned before how one of your career dreams is to to present documentaries on film.
Yeah.
What is it about film that so interests you?
I think it's because I sort of like, I think that's how I understand the world.
Mm.
Like, I am like a student of pop culture. I love film and TV, and I watch loads of video essays about like pop culture and how film and TV interacts with the real world, and like how you can spot trends, and how just like it's how I understand everything. It's sort of like how I understand romance and sitcoms for like work, like workplace comedy and stuff like that. And like even beauty, I think, is like a big one for sort of like the film and TV industry, or just sort of like how women are perceived, because my BA dissertation, which was English, but I still did films for it because you could, like, anything as a text if you want it to be.
Yeah.
And I spoke about sort of, like, how, like, the sex symbol, like, the sort of, like, female sex symbol, like, turns into, like, the hag, like, the washed-up, like, sort of star, like, Sunset Boulevard, you know, like, Norma Desmond, that sort of thing. And I like how stuff can be metatextual. Like, I did my MA dissertation on The King of Comedy and how, you know, they have Jerry Lewis playing basically Jerry Lewis and, you know, and like, and how it's interesting how an actor is perceived in real life has an impact on the roles that they play and will be used within the roles that they play. Mm. And I find that fascinating. But yeah, I think it is just sort of like, in a general sense, is how I understand the world. I also just like love it. I think that film is really cool. And it's weird that like, it's kind of sad, like cinema as a thing is kind of dying, and it's sort of like Marvel is a monopoly now. And like summer indies don't quite exist anymore.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, okay, the world is changing, and I think it's important for, like, I think it's great that, like, a Best Picture film can, like, not be in the English language.
Mm.
And sort of, like, if a film isn't international, it's just not going to do as well anymore. And I think that's important, like, to recognise that the world is changing in that sense. But I'm just not a big fan of Marvel. So, like, that's annoying.
And you were longlisted in 1,000 Films Female Writing Competition.
Yes, yeah.
What was that? What did you write for that?
So it was a script that I wrote with my friend Pasha. It's called Parasol. It's still like, the script is still in the, we've been like rewriting it a little bit. But it's sort of about, I mean, like, it's weird because we started writing it ages ago, just as for a bit of fun. Mm-hmm. And then when we like sent it off to places, we were like, oh, is this good? Oh, okay. Like, we have to work on it. Oh, God. Like, but it was initially about two girls who'd sort of like come out of uni, and they were just kind of stupid, and like maybe like book smart and academically smart, but just like not life smart, and had no skills, and very much like lived in their own world and sort of did stuff and were like, I don't know, pretentious and performative for each other, and like didn't really care about other people. but in like a fun, silly way. Hmm. And we sort of rewrote it to have them be like, because we're like, we're older now. The world is a bit of a darker place now. Mm-hmm. And so we had them be like, one of them's like finished a PhD and the other one was just waiting for the other one to finish the PhD. And they're like, okay, now we can start living. And it's sort of about them having no life skills and being like, it was called Parasol because for no reason really, like, it's just sort of like, what's a nice thing. But the sort of the plot of the first episode, which is probably not the plot anymore, so I think it's fine to, but it's still like going to be a part of it, is like they're trying to get a deposit for a flat. Like, they need to get a deposit to, like, and not like to like buy one, just to rent, like just to rent a flat and like move out of their parents. And but then they're just sort of like, they walk past an antique shop and they see a chaise longue and they're like, well, obviously we need that. And so they just buy the chaise longue instead and they can't move out. And so there's like a beautiful like image of them just like sitting on the chaise longue in like a park. And I just thought that was really funny, like just to be like so flippant with something when both of us as writers live with our parents and like are like, when are we going to move out? Because I think I like that tension of like, because you live with your parents, like, because we're from London, it's like, it's not, and we're both like from the Caribbean, it's like quite normal to stay with your parents like until like you're a fair bit older, but it still feels, but we're still Western, and so it's like, oh, this is bad. But also in this economy, it's really hard, like, even like everyone, all of my friends from like all different walks of life, like if they're from London, they live with their parents for a long time, because like, how can you afford to rent? But just having this sort of like tension between them working and having a little bit of disposable income, mm-hmm. but living with their parents, mm-hmm. and like, so being able to like buy stupid shit, but not being able to progress into adulthood, yeah. and feeling a bit stunted. Because I live with my parents and I don't know like when I'm going to move out.
No, I did until very recently.
Oh.
So yeah, it's a very relatable concept.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I hope it becomes a thing.
Me too. Yeah. Like, tell someone about it.
Yeah. It's like a British version of Booksmart.
Yeah. Like, we sort of, like, I really like Booksmart, and I love how, like, there's, like, no villains in that show. Like, everyone is, like, a fun character, you know? It's not really like, oh, my God, this person's against me. It's like, we're all stupid teenagers.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Because we both, when me and Pasha started writing it, neither of us had seen Broad City before. Then we were like, oh, shit, this is, like, a way better version of what we want this to be. And but we're like, no, it's fine, because we've not seen it before.
Sure.
But I do like, I think like Broad City is so important because it's like a stoner duo sort of show. Mm. And the girls in our show wouldn't be like stoners, but just sort of like dumb and do things for themselves. And it's not like, oh my God, I need to find myself in the big city. It's not girls.
Yeah.
It's just like, let's go on an adventure.
Yeah.
That absolutely. Sort of thing.
And you don't need to worry about it passing the Bechdel test or things like that.
Yeah.
It puts sort of young female voices right at the centre.
Yes.
And without sort of having to be defined by...
Exactly.
Do they like me, apart from a very sort of small, maybe like subline story in episode 4. And that's the most useful.
And like all the male characters we wrote were so basic and stupid. Like they were so... Like one of them was called like Greg, the graphic designer. And he like...
Oh yeah, I think I know.
He like cycled everywhere and wore like stupid cycling clothes. It was just like so dumb.
I love that. Good to continue wearing cycling clothes, even if he gives up cycling.
Exactly.
He likes the lycra.
Yeah.
You've mentioned before your love for the show Bob's Burgers.
Oh my God.
What about Bob's Burgers so drives you?
I think it's genius. It's like, if you want an image for like the show, like my home screen is this.
Oh wow! we'll take a screenshot.
It's because it's Jean dressed as Queen Latifah, and an image of Queen Latifah in the same costume. I think it's so funny. That's been my home screen for like 6 years. I think it's such a well-written show. It's a really, really amazingly written show because you could sort of like just listen to it. You don't even have to watch. Sure, like, yeah. You could listen to an episode like if you're not paying that much attention. Because I think with the nature of cartoons, they got to sound interesting and good as well because sometimes people don't pay as much attention to cartoons.
Yeah.
But the puns are amazing. I'm not someone who like likes puns, but like in Bob's Burgers, there'll be something and I'll be like, ha! Yeah. And I think everyone in that family is just so perfect for one another. Like, they all fit in so perfectly with each other. Because, like Jean, Louise and Tina, like, they're all different ages. They're all in different grades. And they still, like, sit together at lunch, which is just so sweet. And I just, like, genuinely, I think it's pure genius. I it's so fun. And simple and sweet. And I love cartoons I love loads and loads of cartoons, but I think Bob's Burgers is my favourite. It's just genius.
It's a wonderful show. And it seems to sort of be buried for a while. And
Similar to
Motherland, which you referenced.
Mm.
It was under the radar and then it suddenly wasn't. And then it was suddenly right there in public consciousness.
Yeah.
And deservedly so.
Yeah.
Now, your show here is a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
Although, as I said before, it doesn't feel like a work in progress. It feels very solid.
Oh, thank you.
How do you approach writing comedy? Are you someone who writes on stage? Do you have a sort of... Yeah, how do you write?
It's a mixture, and I think I'm still discovering how I write, because what I've noticed whilst I've been here and I've been able to like focus on the show way more than I would at home, because I work during the day, so like I'm gigging in the evenings, and so I'll just sort of like make a list of my set and just say those things. But now I'm like sort of like trying to add new jokes before, like an hour before, and like looking at it, listening back afterwards and trying to figure out more stuff, because I really feel like I'm like working the muscles whilst I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a bit, I think there's sort of a bit in the show when I'm sort of like trying to interrogate my way of thinking and I'm talking about tattoos and weddings. That bit I sort of sat down and typed, like not in the full extent that it is now, but I was thinking all these things and I was like, let me just try and sit down and write it.
Sure.
And I felt like, and I was like, oh, this is, why didn't I do this before? Mm-hmm. This is, and I felt like that material was maybe where I was being the most myself. And I was really proud of it because I've written it specifically for the show, which I'd never really done before. Like when I've done shows before, it's just sort of like, I'm not really shows, like I like the longest I'd ever done in a show before would be like half an hour when I split it.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of just like a combination of all my material I had, or like the material I had that year, and just like saying it one after the other. Because I also like, for ages, I was like, I don't really like segues. I think they're pointless. Like, I think they're like, it's like treating the audience like they're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis, who's the live producer at my agency, was like, sometimes you got to treat the audience like they're stupid, Mary. And I was like, what? Because like, I really hate it when someone's like speaking off. I'm like, oh, shut the fuck up. Shut up. Because sometimes my stuff is so disparate and I'm like, this and this is never going to link.
Yeah.
But it makes sense for me to put them in this order. But I'm like, do you know what? No, we can't, especially in like a longer show. It can be a little bit disarming to like, or just no, like disarming the right word. Like it can be a bit weird, like jarring to have like go from this to this with there being no connection. And so you want to ease people in and you want to tell a story. And so I'm also just seeing that a pattern more in the way that I think, because this show is sort of like interrogating why I think certain things. And so I'm like, oh, I write stuff about this. I write stuff about this. It's because, and these are linked in some way, and I'm seeing a pattern, and it's just because I want to do clowning. Like that's the, I don't know. But I'm seeing like a pattern where I'm talking about, because the show is about sort of like freedom and not being able to be neutral. And so being annoyed that other people can rebel because they start off neutral and I can't rebel because I'm not starting off neutral. Whoa.
I'll just go and see who that is.
Yeah, sure.
That's not happened before. Sorry, could you say that again? Okay, sure. have done something good or let a serial killer in. cool. I got another individual. We'll just double up. sorry about that. Where were we?
I don't know. Talking about... Oh, yeah, just, like, seeing patterns in my material.
Right.
And I think it's nice to notice that about yourself. Because, yeah, a lot of the time, I'll just be, like, in terms of, like, how I write jokes, I'll be, like, I'll be on the tube, and I'm, like, that's funny.
Yeah.
And I'll just, like, make a note in my phone, and then eventually maybe, like, work it out on stage, and it'll become something. But... I am sort of like, but it's important to not just, because I think I was quite bitty before, and I'm still quite bitty. I feel like I still have like bits.
Sure.
But it's important to make routines. So people remember routines. Like you can have a 5-minute routine about something. And I have a few routines, and it's funny because out of the pandemic, the first sort of routine I had was about pornography, and that I talk about that in an earlier iteration of the show, but it doesn't really work within the show. It's just sort of, it's kind of a separate bit. But I was just so proud that I had like 7 minutes on porn.
7 minutes in heaven.
Yeah, yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah, I'm sure. yeah, and I suppose if you get sort of a really good bit, that's where the merchandise comes from. It's a line from that.
Yeah.
In addition to Girl Boss question mark on your flask.
I know. It's so like, I'm still trying to figure out a way of explaining that properly. Because there is something problematic about, firstly, like Girl Boss feminism is kind of bad.
Yeah.
Because it's like...
It's almost like a sort of Fisher Price version of power.
Yeah.
It's like my first hegemony.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's sort of like... oh, you're, like, being, like, this is cool because business is a male-dominated industry, like, or whatever business you're in and stuff like that. But it's, like, you still can't treat people badly.
Yeah.
Like, you still, like, just because you're a girl boss doesn't mean that you can, like, do whatever you want and treat people badly. And, like, the nature of, like, capitalism and a lot of, like, entrepreneurship and stuff is treating people badly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I'm like, girl boss? Question mark?
Yes. So you're saying, am I one and would I want to be one?
Kind of, yeah. Because I'm like, yeah. Because I don't think I am one. I don't think I have the work ethic. I don't know, actually.
That's the spirit. That's what Simone de Beauvoir's going for. was there a particular teacher at school that inspired you? Either for good or bad?
I wouldn't necessarily say so. I've had some, like, cool teachers. Do you know what? I used to do taekwondo, and my teacher, Tony, he would make us, like, do homework, like, written homework, like, where we'd, like, talk about a topic. Uh-huh. Like, and so it'd be like, I want you to talk about... And it'd be, like, a sort of social thing. So it'd be like, I would need a page on this. And I'm like... This has got nothing to do with, like, taekwondo. but I think it did get us to, like, think critically.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like, A-level philosophy. And so you sort of, like, interrogate things. And I liked both my philosophy teachers. And I remember reading... I read, like, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, like, a cool book. And there's something that... I want to maybe interrogate in, like, another show with being, like... Because, like, I'm, like, I'm not a libertarian because I don't think that you can be in this world anymore. But there's something about, like, I'm, like... But if everyone was good, then it's, like, well, yeah, like, everyone be free to do what you want. Because I don't care. I don't really care, like, what everyone else does as long as it's, like, not harming others.
Sure.
But, like, but we can't really trust people to not harm others. And so I'm, like... And so it's, like, being conflicted with being, like, I think everything should be, like, fine, libertarian, whatever, but also, like, welfare state. Like, we need to look after people and that kind of conflict. But, like, I don't believe completely... I don't believe in free market capitalism because it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the nature of like humanity is, I don't know, nasty, brutish and short. Hobbes, what? I can quote, no, I don't know. I don't know. Like
Browning and Hobbes, it's the full spectrum.
I'm honestly so smart.
Yeah.
Like it's crazy. And I'm good looking. What?
For the listeners, God. It was good to...
Look me up, guys. Check out this face. But yeah, I like... and I thought that book was really interesting. And I guess I feel like I can... I like to think a little bit philosophically, but also, like, I like the fact that I'm so dumb and shallow. I like that it's like this sort of, like, stupid bitch's guide to capitalism. I think that's what my show is a little bit about.
That's the title for this,
yeah. Stupid bitch's guide to capitalism. And I like deliberately misunderstanding things. I think that's a fun thing to do. That's what that sort of Getty Images joke is. Yeah.
Fantastic. What's the best advice you received? What's the worst advice you received?
Best advice. I don't know if it's necessarily like been directly given to me, but someone was like, someone was having a little bit of a really cool performer, but was having a difficult time in comedy. And she was like, I was just like, someone else was talking to me and they were like, follow your bliss. Cause I'm like, I have my sort of impression of comedy is like stand up can be a thankless job. It can be like a thankless job where I'm like, why do we do this? What is the point? Like, is it making you happy? But I think it's important to realize that there's not one way to do it. There's other ways of finding an audience and doing it on your own, because it's not quite a meritocracy. Like, obviously, like, people have to be talented, but there's can be loads of like institutions behind them, and like, how much money do they have to pay attention to this and that, and trying not to get caught up in that, and trying to just sort of like, so like, following your bliss, which is something that I don't do yet, because I'm like, I'll enjoy myself when I'm a millionaire, okay?
But back to the finances again.
But also I think good advice is like what I would say, like, I think you should, like, in terms of like how you appear on stage, is like dress like what your material represents.
Oh, that's a good one.
I think like, because you don't have to put loads of thought into it, but I think it's sort of like, you know, it's an impression of you.
Sure.
Dress like, so like, I try, if I'm doing stand-up, I try and look nice, because I'm like, I used to do jokes about like having pretty privilege, and I'm like, well, I've got to look pretty, because like, otherwise they'll be like, she's not even that pretty. So I think you should sort of like dress like what your material represents, dress in that vibe. Worst advice? I don't know, people will give you like unsolicited advice, but the thing is, you don't have to take it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, like, I try and not be too affected by other stuff, because it's like, it's fine, you have your opinion, that's fine, but like, you don't have to take someone else's advice. I think you should listen to all the advice. I mean, you should listen to it,
mm-hmm.
But you don't have to take it. And try not get in your head about it. So I don't know if there's any worse advice. I can't think of any.
Well, that's a very solid bit of advice. What is the best gig you've had? What is the worst gig you've had?
This is an interesting one, because like, I've been asked this like maybe like once before, and I would say, I guess I feel like the best gigs are yet to come, which like, but that's in terms of, I had a really nice one a couple months ago where I sort of perform a fair bit in the like queer liberal woke scene, because I am technically those things,
mm-hmm.
but my material takes a while to get there, because like
Thatcherism.
And I did a gig, it was Grace and Mads Big Night Out. And Grace and Mads were like an amazing sketch duo. They're super, super funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a little bit of like a mixture. There was like a poet, there was drag. And I like doing those sorts of shows. Because sometimes it goes super badly when people have been like you can't quite go from music to comedy. It depends on the nature of the show. But it was great because I saw the audience and I was like, I don't know if they're going to like this. Mm. Like, I don't know, because I was talking about marriage and tattoos and, like, having traditional thoughts and trying to interrogate that. So, like, the stuff that I'm doing in the show. But I was like, I think this audience will be like, who is this conservative bitch? Who let her in here?
Yeah.
Because I'm, like, because I'm interrogating, like, having traditional views, but, like, the conflict with, like, being who I am. But they loved it. Yeah. They fucking loved it. Like, I was getting, like, finger snaps, you know? Like, mm-hmm. And it was so much fun because I was like, oh, okay, like, it can work. I'm not... Because it's sort of like, I think it shows... Because I'm, like, taking the piss. I'm taking the piss out of people with tattoos. I'm taking the piss out of... because I'm like, we're all friends here. And so I think we can take the piss out of each other.
Yeah, gentle ribbing.
Yeah. But it was just the fact that I was like, I don't know if this is going to go down well at all. And they were like, they loved it. And they really responded to it with like an amazing energy. Worst gig. I don't know. I've had like, I said this on the other podcast. And so it's like, it happened at the Fringe. And so I feel a little bit weird having like being at the Fringe. Cause I have like a fair bit of racism happened to me when I'm here. And I think it's because I'll repeat myself on the other podcast, but like, I think it's from English people. And I think it's because they think God isn't watching in Scotland. and so like, there was this one gig I did and it was on Grass Market. There was like this van called like the Titter Truck or something where it was like, so you literally go in, you do like your 10-minute spot and that's it. Like people see like, maybe one or two acts doing 10 minutes and they pay like £1 to get in.
It's on a truck.
It's in a truck. It's in a van. I don't think it's here anymore because why?
Yeah.
But like, I couldn't even say if this was the worst gig. I didn't really die. It's just, I started talking, I was saying some stupid shit about like feeling fresh to death because like there's no toilet paper at the Fringe, you know, like at a certain stage. Mm-hmm. And this old man at the back was like, sorry, I don't understand jive. And I was like, oh no. I was like, oh, that's racist.
Wow.
And he was like, oh, was it? Oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. I was like, yeah, it's a bit like, you know, but I was like, I don't think you're gonna like the rest of the show. I don't and like they wouldn't let, like they couldn't let go of the fact that I just called them racist for calling me jive.
Yeah.
And so we sort of like had an argument and like, they were like, oh, you're never going to make it in this industry if this is like, I was like, you just called me jive. You heckled me. You interrupted me and called me jive. Like,
yeah.
And so, and they were like, we're leaving. I was like, leave, leave. You paid £1 to get in here. I don't give a shit.
It's a van.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, and they were like, I'll leave with you. I'll make a scene. You think you can make a scene and I'm not going to contribute to this scene? I was like, he just called me jive. I said to everyone in Grass Market that he called me jive. And I'm like, babes, if it's what black people were called in the 70s, it's not what you should say to them now.
Yeah.
And I know it's not the worst thing that could ever happen or whatever. And it's probably not even my worst gig. It's just something that I like remember because I was like, oh, I was like 30 seconds in.
Wow.
And this is what you've said to me.
Yeah.
And so can you imagine if I'd just been doing some clowning? I don't know. Maybe it would have gone down better.
yeah, that's... and such an odd
thing. I know. What a... What?
Unless he was directly quoting Airplane. I cannot understand.
No.
Yeah.
So retro.
Exactly. I mean, it's pretty haunted in Edinburgh. Your room you're in is probably the most fringiest fringe room. It's a cinema within a gay heavy metal pub.
Oh, is it gay? I don't know it was
I
gay.
I saw a lot of pride flags, sorry. But it's also within the world's most haunted pub or in Scotland. Were you aware of this?
I didn't know my venue was haunted.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it because there's like, I guess there's like a chamber room or whatever. Like and like lots of people like do sort of like... No, I don't know. I don't know what I'm thinking of. And like a lot of the other shows on are like ghost story kind of shows. And I'm like, feminism and capitalism for stupid bitches. But now that I know that it's haunted, I don't know. I'm not a big fan of ghosts.
I'm sorry to have ended your run so early. Week and a half in. You've had a good run.
Yeah, I've had a good run.
You made some friends. Yeah, good laughs.
Do you know what? I'll address it in the crowd work. I'll do it next gig. I'll address it.
Fantastic. Well, I my final question is quite simply, why do we need stories?
I guess we need stories because it's important to just sort of like hear about other people's lived experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they don't always have to be necessarily personal stories, but we need, I think stories like whether it's from real life or fiction, it's still like, it still tells you something about the world. It still tells you something about someone else. And I like that it's a way to connect with people. Like, I think stories are a way to connect with people. Stand-up is a way to connect with people because you're sort of like, you're performing, and when people laugh, it kind of means that they've connected with you. Like, they either, like, agree or they understand, like, what you mean. And that's kind of, like, the most important thing is just sort of, like, human connection. And stories help with that because if you've, like, heard about, I don't know, what someone else is going through or someone, I don't know, people are able to reference something that you get, then you make a connection with someone. And I think that's super important. And it's also good to document stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, but like, yeah, all types of stories are important. Funny ones are the best. Mm-hmm. But that's my bias.
And fantastic, funny storytelling show, Something Wrong With Mary. I hope that you'll tour it because it's a fantastic show and many, many people should be watching.
Oh, thanks, man.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. And have a wonderful rest of the Fringe. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you so much for having me.